There are places that feel ordinary right up until the moment they aren't. A driveway, a sidewalk, a neighborhood street at the end of a regular afternoon. The kind of place where kids have walked 100 times. The kind of place that shows up in everyone's memory as safe. Background sounds, a neighbor's dog barking, someone's garage door rolling up, a car moving slow down a residential block. And then, in the space between one breath and the next, everything changes. I'm Maya Vale. This is Among Monsters. And today, I'm taking you to Springfield, Missouri, to a street that couldn't mean what it means now, to a February afternoon that became one of the most defining moments in a city's history. To the story of a 10-year-old girl named Haley Owens. A little girl who was walking home. Stay with me. Some stories have to begin before the crime. They have to begin in the ordinary, in the everyday texture of life that should have continued. Because if we skip straight to the terrible moment, we miss the point. And the point is exactly this. None of this was supposed to happen. Springfield, Missouri sits in the southwest corner of the state, tucked in the foothills of the Ozarks, about halfway between Kansas City and Memphis, if you're drawing a line across the map. It's a mid-sized city, families, schools, churches, Friday night football, quiet neighborhoods where people know each other's names and wave from their driveways and think of certain blocks as extensions of their own living rooms. It is not a city that feels dangerous. It is a city that feels like home. The kind of place where kids ride bikes to the end of the block and parents watch from porches and nobody imagines that the afternoon has anything extraordinary planned. The kind of city that sees itself as apart from the kind of violence that makes national news. And for a long time, it could. Not because tragedy never touched Springfield. Every city knows sorrow. Every zip code has its stories. But there is a particular kind of violence. The kind that arrives in broad daylight, on a residential street, in front of witnesses against a child. That a city never really prepares for. It can't. Not emotionally. Not institutionally. Not in a way that people actually live their daily lives and make the 1,000 small decisions that add up to something called routine. Because preparing for that would mean accepting that safety is a story we tell ourselves. And most people would rather believe the story. Most people should be able to believe the story. The tragedy of February 18, 2014 is partly that a community's responsible faith in its own safety was weaponized against it. That the abductor knew what ordinary looked like because he had spent years inside it. That he knew how to approach a child on a sidewalk in a way that looked for just a half second like nothing more than someone asking for directions. He knew how to use the language of the ordinary, and he used it to do the most extraordinary act of harm imaginable. Haley Owens was 10 years old in February of 2014. 10. Old enough to walk to a friend's house. Old enough to navigate a familiar neighborhood. Old enough to feel the particular independence that comes when adults start trusting you with a little more space. Young enough that the world should have still felt large and forgiving and mostly good. Young enough that the worst things in it should have still felt far away. The details of her life before that day are the details of childhood everywhere. School mornings, weekend routines, the social landscape of fifth grade, friendships and lunch tables and inside jokes, and all the small, vivid dramas of being 10 years old in a regular town. A family who loved her, a future that was supposed to keep unfolding. And on the afternoon of February 18th, 2014, she was doing something completely unremarkable. She was walking, just walking. down a Springfield sidewalk in her neighborhood in the last stretch of the afternoon. The sun would have been low at that hour in February, the air cold, the kind of late winter afternoon where the light already looks like it's thinking about leaving. She was probably thinking about whatever 10-year-olds think about on the walk home. A friend, a show she wanted to watch, something someone said at school, the ordinary, invisible thoughts of an ordinary day. She had no reason to think that day was different. No alarm, no premonition, no sign posted at the edge of the neighborhood warning that something terrible was already moving toward her. That is one of the most devastating truths in cases like this one. Evil almost never announces itself. It just appears, dressed in ordinary clothes, driving an ordinary truck, moving down an ordinary street, hiding behind the most disarming disguise of all, normal. It was a tan Ford Ranger. That detail matters because details are how witnesses carry the truth. According to accounts from the Missouri Supreme Court's review of trial evidence, neighbors Carlos and Michelle Edwards were outside when they saw Haley walking down the sidewalk. They saw the truck pass her, and then they watched it turn around. The truck came back down the block, slowed, and pulled up alongside her. The driver leaned out and asked her for directions. It seemed for a second like nothing. One of those forgettable interactions between a stranger and a kid. Directions to somewhere. Politely declined. Haley started to walk away, and then the door opened. The driver grabbed her, forced her into the truck. And before the neighbors standing on that sidewalk could fully register what they were seeing, the truck was moving fast. I want you to sit with that sequence for a moment, because in written form, it takes longer to read than it took to happen. In real time, it was seconds. A handful of seconds in which an entire city's sense of itself was rearranging permanently. One of the hardest things about sudden violence is what it does to the witnesses. Not just legally, not just in terms of what they saw and reported, but personally. Because the human mind, when it encounters something it cannot process fast enough, replays it endlessly. Could I have moved sooner? Could I have shouted louder? Could one more step forward, one faster turn, one sharper scream have changed the outcome? The brain punishes itself for not being faster than a truck, for not being there 1 second earlier. And that punishment doesn't end when the moment ends. It follows people. It shows up years later at unexpected times, a particular angle of afternoon light, a vehicle that matches that color, the sound of someone calling out. And suddenly the body is back on that street, running, lungs burning, reaching towards something already gone. That is what trauma does to memory. It doesn't file things away neatly. It keeps them at the surface, ready to be pulled back up at the slightest prompt. And these witnesses, these regular people who stepped outside on a February afternoon not expecting anything at all, they carry a weight that most of the people who covered this story never stopped to calculate. But here is what I also need to say. Because the witnesses in this case did something important, something that mattered more than they may ever know. They didn't freeze. They acted. They saw what was happening, and they moved. They shouted. They called 911. They ran. They chased. One neighbor reportedly tried to follow the truck. They remembered details, a color, a model, a direction, a license plate number. Think about that. Under that kind of shock, in that kind of panic, they held on to a plate number. And in a case like this, those details were not just helpful. They were the thread that law enforcement would use to pull everything else into the light. That plate number was a lifeline. And ordinary people standing on an ordinary street held onto it while their hands were shaking and their hearts were pounding and the world had just stopped making sense. I think about that whenever the word helpless gets used in connection with bystanders. These people were not helpless. They were overwhelmed, and they acted anyway. That matters. Law enforcement in Springfield, Missouri moved fast. And in cases involving abducted children, speed is not just a virtue. It's a survival arithmetic. Every minute is a variable. Every minute changes the math. Officers work from the information witnesses had provided. The license plate number, the description of the truck, the direction it was last seen heading. And it led them to Craig Wood. When police arrived at his home, the same tan Ford Ranger was in the driveway. As an officer approached, Wood got out of the truck and he tossed a roll of duct tape into the truck bed. That is the first thing court records note about his behavior at the scene, a roll of duct tape. He appeared nervous. Officers noted that he smelled of bleach. And according to court record, Wood acknowledged that he knew why officers were there. He knew. He didn't ask what was happening. He didn't express confusion. He knew. There is a specific kind of silence that arrives when evidence starts to speak louder than hope. When investigators first arrived at the scene or knock on the door, there is still room, however small, for something to bend the other direction. Maybe she's here. Maybe she's alive. Maybe this ends differently than it looks like it's going to end. But then the details come. The truck. The tape. The bleach smell. The admission, and the room for hope begins to narrow. Not disappear. Not yet, but narrow. Because everyone in law enforcement at the scene had experience, and experience was whispering something very hard to hear. Wood agreed to go with officers for questioning. He did not answer questions about where Haley was. Officers, during their interaction with him and their initial look at the property, noticed dried blood on him. And when investigators entered the home, the basement told its own story. A powerful smell of bleach coming from below. Wet steps. Wet flooring. A fan running. Duct tape on the floor. Empty bleach containers. Large plastic storage tubs. That is what they found when they walked down those stairs. And every single item on that list, in isolation, could belong to any house. Bleach under the sink, storage tubs in the basement, a fan running, none of it, alone, means anything terrible. But together, after what witnesses had seen, after the truck, after the tape, after the way Wood looked at the officers when they pulled up, together, those ordinary objects became the outline of something unbearable. That is another thing this case illuminates about violent crime. Evil does not always hide in exotic places. It does not require a remote location or some elaborate concealment. Sometimes it lives inside architecture that looks completely normal from the street. A house with a driveway, a basement with a concrete floor, the smell of something that people use to clean their bathrooms, the mondoon wrapped around the monstrous. When officers conducted a fuller search of the home, they found Haley Owens in the basement. She had been wrapped in black plastic bags and placed inside one of those large plastic tubs. An autopsy would later determine that she had been sexually assaulted and killed by a gunshot to the back of the neck. I want to be direct about something here. I'm not going to dwell on those details. Not because the truth shouldn't be named, but because the truth has been named. And what matters now is not the brutality of the act. What matters is what was taken. A 10-year-old girl who was supposed to walk home. The future versions of Haley that her family would now only be able to imagine. The birthdays that would never arrive as expected. The years of growing up that were stolen before they began. The wound that's left in her parents, in her siblings, in her classmates, in her teachers, in every person who carried some piece of that day forward. That is the true scale of what happened on February 18th, 2014. It did not end with one life. It detonated through dozens, and the aftershock reached far beyond any courthouse. When a crime like this happens, People immediately want to understand the person who committed it. And I think that impulse is honest. Because if we can understand who they are, maybe we can understand how they move through the world undetected. Maybe we can understand what we missed. Maybe we can build a sharper picture of what to look for. Craig Wood was not a stranger lurking at the edge of the community. He was embedded in it. Reporters at the time identified him as a teacher's aide and football coach at Pleasant View School in Springfield, a school employee, working with children every day, known to families, trusted with proximity to kids. Think about what that means in practical terms. He was in classrooms. He was on the practice fields. He knew children's names. He knew their schedules. He occupied a role that parents, especially parents in a community like Springfield, were taught to accept as safe. Because teachers, aides, and coaches earn a kind of social trust that doesn't have to be negotiated. It comes preloaded with the institution they represent. The school vouches for the person, the school uniform, in a sense, in a credential. And people tend to extend benefit of the doubt to credentialed institutions and the people inside them. That is not a character flaw in the parents or the community. It is how civic life functions. It is how we manage the daily practical reality of having to extend trust to people we cannot know completely. But it is also sometimes exactly what predators exploit. They find the institutions where trust flows automatically. They wear the roles that lower people's guard. They learn to perform competence and warmth and dependability well enough to survive inspection. And that is what makes the betrayal cut so deeply when the mask finally comes off. That fact deepened the wound in a specific way that people who followed this case describe over and over. Because betrayal cuts in a particular place when the person wearing the mask of trust is someone communities are specifically asked to trust. Parents send their children to school with the understanding that the adults inside those walls are safe. That is the implicate agreement. That is the faith that holds the whole system together. And when that faith is violated, not by a stranger from somewhere else, but by someone sitting in a classroom, calling plays on the practice field, learning the names and habits of children, the violation goes deeper than the act itself. It contaminates everything around it, every assumption about proximity, every decision that felt safe in hindsight, every time a parent thought, well, he works at the school, so he's fine. That is the cruelest form of betrayal. Not only what he did, but how thoroughly normal his life appeared. And when investigators later searched his home more carefully, they found something that confirmed what the rest of the evidence suggested. This was not impulsive. This was not some sudden rupture in a previously stable life. There was a history. Court records described writings found in the home involving sexual fantasies about young girls, and photographs of girls who were students at the school where he worked. Those findings tell a specific story, a story of fixation, of obsession, cultivated in private, of an appetite that had been building in the dark long before February 18th. And that is one of the most unsettling truths in cases involving child predators. The danger rarely emerges overnight. It doesn't arrive one morning out of nothing. It grows, fed in silence, protected by how ordinary everything else looks. That is what makes it so difficult to detect. That is what leaves entire communities saying the same thing after the arrest. I never would have guessed. And maybe they're telling the truth. Maybe they really wouldn't have. Because evil that survives long-term in public life learns how to look plain. It learns what to say, how to stand, which door to open and which door to close. It learns the performance of normalcy so thoroughly that normalcy is all anyone ever sees until the afternoon it isn't. The investigation into Craig Wood didn't rely on questions he wouldn't answer because the evidence answered for him. It mentioned the bleach bottles in the basement, the duct tape, the fan, the wet flooring, but the investigation spread wider than the house. Police found evidence that Wood had discarded Haley's clothing in a dumpster not far from his home. Surveillance footage captured him doing it, and Walmart records and receipts connected him to purchases made after the abduction. Bleach, drain cleaner, a laundry bag, more duct tape. Purchase after purchase, decision after decision, a chain of deliberate actions taken the hours after a child was murdered. That is what this evidence tells you. Not chaos. Not a person coming undone in some sudden, uncontrollable moment. The receipts tell you about time management, about errands, about awareness and planning in the aftermath. One of the oldest defenses available to evil is the calm of impulsivity. The argument that things spun out of control, that nothing was deliberate, that the person was barely themselves. But evidence has a way of stripping that argument down. It turns actions into a timeline, a timeline into a pattern into intent. And here, the timeline was clear. The abduction, the return to the home, the purchases, the disposal of evidence, the bleach, the storage containers, the fan. Each item on that list represents a choice, and every choice was made by someone who knew exactly what he was doing. The forensic picture that investigators assembled was, by every account, overwhelming. Witnesses who saw the abduction, a license plate that led directly to the suspect, physical evidence at the scene, surveillance footage, receipts with a timestamp, biological evidence, materials found in the home that spoke to a broader pattern of fixation. There was no mystery here. There was only documentation. And piece by piece, that documentation would be carried into a courtroom and laid out for a jury in a case that the public had been waiting years to see resolved. Because while evidence moves at the speed of investigation, justice moves at the speed of due process. And those are not the same speed, not even close. Before the trial, before the verdict, before any of the legal language that would eventually place structure around the act of pure destruction, before all of that, the city did what cities do when words fail. It gathered. It gathered in grief, in shock, in the need to be somewhere near other human beings who understood without explanation why they were there. Court testimony and later reporting described over 10,000 people attending a vigil for Haley Owens. 10,000 people in a mid-sized city in southwest Missouri. 10,000 people who came with candles, with prayers, with their children held close, with tears they didn't try to hide, with faces that carried the specific expression communities wear after a tragedy that reaches into something fundamental. That number is not just an attendance figure. It is a census of heartbreak. It is proof that grief, at a certain magnitude, stops being private. It overflows the family. It overflows the neighborhood. It becomes communal in the truest sense. You don't have to know a child personally to mourn what happened to her. You only need to know what childhood is supposed to mean, what safety is supposed to mean, what it feels like to walk your own kid to school and trust that the world will hold them. People came to the vigil carrying all of that. The abstract fear made suddenly, horribly concrete. The recognition that this happened here. On a street people knew, in a neighborhood that looked like their own. And something else was in the crowd too. Something harder to name, but just as real. It was the particular grief that comes from proximity without involvement. The grief of people who drove past that block every day, who walked their dogs on streets just like it, who had children the same age, who understood that on a different afternoon, on a different block, the truck could have slowed for someone they knew. That recognition, that nearness, was part of what made 10,000 people show up. Not spectacle, solitary. The kind that only arrives when something breaks open the ordinary and forces people to acknowledge what they share. The recognition changes a community. Not all at once. Not what they single clear before and after, but in the accumulation of small changes. The parent who now insists on walking their child to the corner. The morning routine that now includes an extra check out the window. The car trip that now ends with the child safely inside before the car pulls away. KY3 reporting from 2024 captured a reflection from Springfield Police Major Tad Peters, who described the community's feelings of innocence being robbed by this case. Robbed. That word is precise. Because it wasn't taken gradually, wasn't eroded slowly over time. It was taken in a single afternoon on a sidewalk in full daylight. Before Haley, Springfield could tell itself certain comfortable things were different. It doesn't happen here. Not in this neighborhood. Not in the daytime. Not in front of witnesses. Not to a child on her way home. After Haley, the city could no longer tell itself those things. And knowledge like that is expensive. It costs something that doesn't come back. I want to stay with the setting for a moment, because it matters in a way that doesn't always get examined. This crime did not happen in darkness. It happened in the afternoon, in daylight, on a street where neighbors were outside, in front of people who could see. And I think this is part of why the case settled so deeply into the collective memory of Springfield. Darkness gives people a kind of psychological cover. It lets them say, well, that's why. The dark, the late hour, the absence of people. Daylight removes that cover entirely. Daylight is supposed to be the safe part of the day. It's what parents point to when they're setting boundaries. You can go, but be back before dark. As if darkness is the variable. As if light is the guarantee. This case broke that assumption. Not theatrically, not statistically, in the most public, documented, witnessed way possible. When a child is taken from a sidewalk in broad daylight, in a neighborhood, in front of people who tried to stop it, the message that delivers is one of the most destabilizing a community can receive. Safety is not guaranteed by visibility. Normalcy is not protection. Being surrounded by familiar places and familiar faces does not mean you are out of reach. Horror can arrive at the curb of an ordinary block at 5 in the afternoon and be gone in seconds. That is the message this crime delivered to Springfield. And it is not a message anyone can easily unknow. There are parents who changed what they allowed because of it. There are children who grew up never having the same kind of freedom their older siblings had. There are routines that were reconstructed around a fear that lived now in the body. Not paranoia, not irrational anxiety, something more honest than that. The acknowledgement that safety is something we build with structure and attention and deliberate care. Not something we can take for granted because it's afternoon and the street is familiar and the neighbors are home. That recollaboration, painful as it is, matters. Because it is the community responding to truth, even when the truth costs something. The trial of Craig Wood began in 2017. 3 years after the abduction, 3 years of hearings and motions and the slow, heavy machinery of a legal process that moves deliberately even when everyone affected is desperate for resolution. That gap between the crime and the courtroom is one of the most difficult parts of these cases for families. Because the world moves forward, the calendar turns, people return to their lives, or some version of them. And the family sits inside something that hasn't moved at all. They are required, again and again, to return to the worst day of their lives, to hear it described in clinical language, to sit in a courtroom where the person who destroyed everything is also sitting, to endure each new legal development as its own event, its own reopening of the wound. 3 years is a long time when you are surviving something instead of living through it. 3 years of having to hold grief in one hand and the practical machinery of existence in the other. Of going to the store and answering questions about how you are doing. Of watching February come around again and again. Of seeing the calendar mark dates that now carry a different weight than they used to. 3 years of that, and then the trial. The evidence presented was comprehensive. Eyewitness testimony from the neighbors who saw the abduction, physical evidence from the truck, forensic evidence from the home, the surveillance footage, the receipts, the materials found in the basement, the writings and photographs that spoke to a deeper, longer pattern. The jury convicted Craig Wood of first-degree murder. The verdict came in November of 2017. However, the jury was unable to reach a unanimous decision on sentencing. Under Missouri law at the time, that meant the sentence fell to the judge. On January 11th, 2018, Greene County Judge Thomas Mountjoy sentenced Craig Wood to death. I want to say something about verdicts and sentences. They matter. They matter because the state has a duty to name evil plainly and respond to it lawfully. They matter because truth deserves a public record. They matter because families deserve to hear guilt declared in a formal, official voice that cannot be argued away. A conviction is a form of documentation. It says, this happened. This person did it. We know. We have named it. We have responded. That matters. But I also want to be honest about what it doesn't do. A verdict does not bring Haley back. A sentence does not reverse a single second of what happened on February 18th. Justice can validate reality, but it cannot repair it. There is no sentence that fills an empty chair at the dinner table. There is no legal outcome that restores a missing birthday. There is no court document that gives back the years. That is why the language of closure feels hollow to families in cases like this. Closure is a word built for doors, for things that can be shut and locked and walked away from. But grief is not a room. It does not have a door. It continues, some days quieter, some days almost bearable, some days arriving without warning in the middle of something ordinary. A name heard in passing, a child's laugh that sounds familiar, February coming around again. That is what stays. That is what the verdict and the sentence cannot touch. One of the things that can emerge from cases like this, not as redemption, because nothing redeems it, but as meaning, is change. Policy change, systematic change, the kind of reform that comes from people who refuse to let a name become only a record. In Missouri, Haley Owens' case became connected to legislation that came to be known as Haley's Law. The purpose of that law centered on improving how child abduction alerts are issued and delivered in Missouri. The goal was speed, getting information to the right people as fast as possible in the critical early minutes of an abduction case. Think about what the witnesses provided on that street. A license plate, a truck description, a direction of travel. That information saved investigative time. It focused the search. It led officers directly to a suspect while the evidence was still fresh. Now imagine if that kind of information could be pushed faster, broader, and more reliably to the public the moment it becomes available. An alert system built for the speed of abduction, not delay, not waiting for the right forms to move through the right channels, but immediate, targeted, widespread alerts that reach phones and screens and radio broadcasts before a vehicle can cross the county line. Every minute in an abduction case is a distance. Every minute is a variable that changes outcomes. And if even one faster alert delivered to the right person in the right place changes what happens to one child, then the name behind the law is doing exactly what names should do. That is what Haley's Law was built to address. And while no law can rewrite what happened on February 18, 2014, a name carried forward into reform is a form of resistance against oblivion. It says this child will not be reduced to an old headline. It says something of value must be built in the long shadows of what was lost. It says memory can become action. It says love can find a way to move forward even when grief cannot. There is dignity in that. Real dignity. Not the kind that eases anything. The kind that offers comfort by softening what happened. But the dignity of refusal. Refusing to let a child's life be remembered only by the way it ended. Refusing to let the lesson go unlearned. Refusing to let the pain pass through the world without leaving something useful behind. That is what families do when the grief is too large to carry and they choose to turn it outward instead. They become advocates. They testify. They push. They carry names into rooms where policy is made. They sit across from legislators and say, "Her name was Haley, and we need this to change." That is one of the most demanding acts of love I can imagine. And it is what happened here. There is a street in Springfield, Missouri. It looks like a lot of streets, sidewalk, yards, cars parked in driveways, trees, the ordinary geometry of American residential life. From the outside, you wouldn't know. You wouldn't know that on one specific afternoon, history cracked open right there on that block. You wouldn't know that witnesses ran from their front yards trying to stop something that was already gone. You wouldn't know that a 10-year-old girl took her last free steps on that sidewalk. But the people who live there know, and the people of Springfield know. And the way they know it, the way it lives in them, it is not dramatic every single day. That's not how permanent grief works. It doesn't announce itself loudly every morning. It doesn't require daily acknowledgement to stay true. It lives in the background, in the habits, in the choices, in the way a February date lands differently than it used to, in the way certain neighborhoods are spoken of with a particular quiet. It lives in parents who still, 10 years later, drive an extra block out of their way because walking past that spot feels like something they can't fully explain but can't stop either. It lives in teachers who were at Pleasant View School in 2014 and who still, sometimes, think about who they trusted and whether trust looks different now. It lives in the first responders who will carry what they saw in that basement forever. That is what this kind of crime does to a community over the long term. It does not destroy people. Not most of them. Not completely. But it changes the architecture of how they move through the world. KY3's coverage, looking back on the 10th anniversary of the case, made that plain. The wound was not healed. The absence was still active. The case had not become history in the way old crimes usually do. Something studied from a comfortable distance. It had stayed close. Haley's family, her classmates, now grown, the neighbors who ran after that truck, the officers who worked the scene, the city that lit 10,000 candles in her name, all of them still carrying some portion of that day. That is a true duration of a crime like this. It doesn't end with an arrest. It doesn't end with the verdict. It doesn't end with the sentence. It continues in the people who loved her, in the people who mourn her, in the people who never met her, but understood immediately when the news broke exactly what had been taken. Haley Owens was 10 years old, 10, an age still close to the full sweetness of childhood, an age when the world is supposed to feel wide and mostly safe, an age when the biggest concerns are supposed to be school and friends and what to have for dinner. She was walking home. That is where the story begins, and that is where I want to end it. Not with the man who took her, not with the truck, not with the evidence and the courtroom and the sentence. With a 10-year-old girl on a sidewalk, walking home, just a kid on an ordinary afternoon, because that is who she was. Not a headline, not a case number, not a symbol, a child, a daughter, a classmate, a person with a future that had no reason not to continue. And that is how she should be remembered first, Every case like this carries the danger of letting the offender become the center of the story. Evil is drawn to attention. It wants to be the axis that everything else turns around. It wants the shock and the horror and the long shadow of its name to outlast everything else. The better act of remembrance is to resist that. To say her name first. To hold on to the child before the crime. To remember the neighborhood not only as a scene of horror, but as a place where people ran, where people called out, where neighbors chased a truck down a street because they refused to stand still while something monstrous happened in front of them. That matters. What those witnesses did was not dramatic in the way movies make drama. It was human, messy and panicked, and maybe fumbling at the edges, but real. They saw evil in the middle of an ordinary afternoon, and they did not look away. They ran toward it. They screamed into phones. They chased with whatever speed they had. They held on to a detail, a number on a plate, under a kind of pressure that most people never experience. That is the other story living inside this tragedy. The story is ordinary people refusing to be indifferent. And then there are 10,000 who came to stand in the dark. I think about that number every time I sit with this case. 10,000 people with candles, with their children close beside them, with grief that had no good place to go, so they brought it there, together to a vigil for a girl most of them had never met, because she was someone's daughter, because she was 10 years old, because some things reach past the boundaries of personal connection and land somewhere deeper in the human chest. That vigil was not just mourning. It was declaration, a city saying out loud, "We see what happened here. We will not look past it. We will not pretend. We will not let Haley Owens become a footnote while we get back to normal." Because normal had been broken. And sometimes, the only honest response to broken things is to stand in the cold together and hold a light. I think about Haley's family. The parents who have lived every day since February 18th of 2014 in a world where she is not. The siblings who grew up alongside her absence, who marked every milestone, graduations, birthdays, ordinary Tuesdays, knowing one person was missing from the picture. There is a specific cruelty in surviving someone you love in that scale, because life does keep going. The world does insist on continuing. Seasons change. Other children grow. The neighborhood fills with new faces who maybe don't know the name. And the family is left carrying something that never gets lighter, only more familiar, never less real. I don't pretend to know what that feels like. I only know that families like Haley's deserve to be seen, deserve to have someone say plainly, "What was taken from you cannot be measured. What you have endured cannot be sufficiently acknowledged by any sentence a judge can deliver." The court did its job. The law named what happened. The verdict was clear. And none of it was enough, because nothing could be. But Haley's name is a law. Her name is in the conversation Springfield has about child safety. Her name is in the extra second a parent waits at the window, in the changed routines, in the held hands, in the way a city learned to love its children a little more fiercely because it learned at the worst possible cost what happens to lose one. Haley Owens is not forgotten. In Springfield, she likely never will be. Because her name is in a law now. Because her story is in the memory of a city that was changed by what happened to her. Because the people who loved her are still here, still carrying her forward in the way that families do when they have no other choice. And because some stories keep breathing long after everyone wishes they could rest, some names stay. Not because the violence attached to them. Not because of who the person was before violence came. A girl walking home. A daughter. A child. A life that deserved to continue. Her name was Haley Owens. And in Springfield, Missouri, she is not forgotten. I'm Maya Vale. This is Among Monsters. Thank you for listening.